in your Bibles to Ecclesiastes. We'll be doing that every night, if you didn't guess. We're still in introductory material in this session, but probably one of the most foundational sessions is this one. Last session we looked at Solomon's life, and we're not really going to go back to that. We're going to get more into the message of the book in this evening. Last night we looked, where does a man's potential lie? Not in his opportunity or his ability, but in his humility. And in this session we're going to look at the intention or the mission of the book, and a little bit at the organization of the book, and then we'll start into the actual discourses of the book in the third session. The first thing I want us to look at is the title, Are You Getting the Point? And that's going to become a crucial thing to recall as we go through this. I want us to begin by looking at Solomon's attitude. What is the flavor of Ecclesiastes? What is his attitude toward life? Unfortunately, there have been there's been much misunderstanding about what Ecclesiastes is about. Even from back in the Reformation, there were Bible scholars and teachers that felt like Ecclesiastes shouldn't even be in the canon. And, of course, we disagree with that. But it is a book that's had a lot of controversy because it is an enigmatic book, or a mysterious book about mysteries. And so it's kind of hard to understand in a lot of ways. And some people have come up with some ideas from it that I think are wrong. Some of them have said that, you know, this shouldn't be in the canon, shouldn't be in the Bible, because he's advocating hedonism. He is not advocating hedonism. Several times he does say, eat and drink and enjoy the good of your labor, but we're going to find out that's not the same emphasis as people today who say, you know, eat and drink and be merry for tomorrow you die. That's not what he is saying in this. He's not advocating hedonism. Although those passages that are listed in your syllabus there are important texts, which we're going to look at in detail later, he's not advocating monasticism, that because all is vexation and vanity, then let's just pull away from life entirely and go bury ourselves in a monastery. He's not making that kind of statement either, and neither is this a pessimistic book. Some people have said, and I think this is one of the views that was made popular by Scofield in his reference edition, that these are the writings of a very pessimistic man, and that all of the things he says in the book are true that he said them, but they're not really true statements in themselves. And I disagree with that position. Ecclesiastes was a book that was read at the Feast of the Tabernacles, a time of joy. And I think that should give us a clue that this book has a very uplifting theme to it, and not this pessimistic view. But it does advocate joy in life. As I mentioned in your notes there, Ecclesiastes was read at the Feast of the Tabernacles, a time of great joy, and joy is a prominent theme mentioned over 17 times. So I just want to help us to get this clear, that this is not a book of pessimism. This is a book of great joy and great optimism when God is in the rightful place in a person's life. Now, something else that really helps us understand this book is understanding Solomon's audience. Most of the books of the Old Testament are written to Israel, and although there is a message here for Israel, I don't believe that its primary audience is Israel. In fact, this book, many scholars believe, is what is called a cultural apologetic. And that means a defense of a particular worldview. And that's very important for us to understand. The term cultural apologetic, and that's in your notes, is a particular literary form that was popular during Solomon's time. Remember, Solomon is called a wise man. Now, it's not just that he was a man who had a great deal of wisdom, but that put him in the circles of people called wise men. Remember, in the New Testament, we hear of these three wise men who came from the East. And these were people who made it their role in life and their calling in life to be soothsayers who said their sooths, you know, so to speak. But these were people who often were in the king's court and would give advice to the king. Daniel was one of this class of wise men, part of the Chaldeans and the wise men and these philosophers of the court. Solomon was a part of this prestigious group. And they would exchange cultural apologetics or these books describing their worldview, and they would write to each other about their worldview, and they would debate each other's worldviews. And that's what we have. You have here in front of you a picture of that hangs in our art gallery over at Bob Jones of the Queen of Sheba visiting Solomon. She is visiting Solomon probably as one of these wise men or wise persons, I guess we could say, who is able to come and test one another with the hard questions of life and try to debate one another's worldview. Now, it wasn't always a mean-spirited, nasty debate like you might have between the Republicans and the Democrats on a, you know, on of our televised debates. But these were exchanges of their cultural worldview, the worldview of their culture, of their own religions. And by the way, that's what I believe that is what is being stated in Ecclesiastes 12. 12:12, where Solomon says, you know, of the making of many books there is no end, and studiness is a weariness of the flesh. You know, that's the life verse of a college student. You know, much study is a weariness of the flesh. But really what Solomon is saying, I believe, is he's writing perhaps to a larger audience, but perhaps also to one philosopher, young budding philosopher that is in his court, at least visiting Jerusalem. And I'll point that out in a little bit later. And he says to this, my son, understand this, that of the making of books there is no end. We can exchange these treaties back and forth in our worldviews between our nations, but you've got to understand this, that it all boils down to this. You have to learn to fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole responsibility of man. And so when he's making this statement of the making of many books, there is no end, I believe he's speaking of these cultural apologetics, these defenses of the worldviews that they would exchange with one another. Turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 11. I believe there was a wider audience, a wider Gentile audience of these wise men, but perhaps, and some scholars believe this, and I think there's evidence for it, that this was also in particularly written for, as I said, one wise young man, a budding philosopher who perhaps had come to learn from Solomon. But in chapter 11, verse 9, he says, rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. And we'll talk about that verse much later on when we get to the end of the book. But there he's addressing it to a young man. In chapter 12, verse 1, he says, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. And so again, it seems like he's addressing this fellow. And then over in chapter 12, verse 12, he says, and further by these, my son, be admonished of making of many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness to the flesh. So it's very possible that Solomon had in mind a particular young man, probably a Gentile, that he is addressing in this. And by the way, since this is, I believe, a cultural apologetic written to a Gentile audience, this is why you don't find in this book any references to Jehovah, the covenant name of Israel. You don't find any references to Jehovah. You don't have any references to Abraham. How can you talk about the Jewish faith without mentioning Abraham? There's no mention of Abraham. And in fact, it is the absence of these elements that caused folks early on, back in the 1600s or so, to want to reject this from the canon. And yet, this format of presenting God as the Creator to whom all of us are accountable is exactly the format that the Apostle Paul took on Mars Hill in Acts 17 when he's speaking to an entirely Jewish audience who didn't know anything about Abraham or Jehovah, the covenant God of Israel. In fact, turn over to Acts chapter 17 and let's look at that. And by the way, this is a great illustration for us when we are dealing with people who know absolutely nothing about the Christian faith. In in Acts 17 here, Paul, verse 16, he says, "Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons, and in the market daily with them that met with him. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him, and some said, 'What will this babbler say?' Others some, 'He seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preacheth unto them Jesus and the resurrection.' And they took him and brought him unto Areopagus," that's Mars Hill, "saying, 'May we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is?'" And this was a place in Athens where all of the philosophers got together and disputed with each other. And as I say, the soothsayers came to say their sooths to each other. Verse 20, "For thou bringest certain strange things to our ears, we would know therefore what these things mean. For all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing." Then Paul, kind of like a modern day Oprah show or something like that. "Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, 'Ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious or very extremely religious.'" That's what he means there. He said, I've been watching in the city and you folks are just embroiled in religion. Verse 23, "For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you.'" He said, you are so intent on religion that I've even, and he's not downgrading them here necessarily, he's just saying, I even saw an altar that, because you didn't want to miss any of the gods, to the unknown God, and I want to tell you who that unknown God is, the one who's unknown to you. Verse 24, how does he present God? God that made the world. He's presenting him as the creator, not the redeemer. These people don't know anything about Jesus. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. Now imagine that impact under the shadow of the Parthenon and all in the pantheon of gods. And I mean, they're surrounded by temples. And he says, you know what? The God who made all of this doesn't even need a temple. And in fact, how can a temple even contain him? Verse 25, "Neither is worshipped with men's hands." They've been, remember Alexander the coppersmith, the silversmith, gave Paul a great problem in Ephesus because he was injuring their trade of selling these images made by hands of the goddess Diana. Verse 25, "Neither is worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything. Seeth he giveth to all life and breath and all things. And he hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell in all the face of the earth. And hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation that they should seek the Lord if happily they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. For as much then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's device." Folks, those were fighting words in Athens. "And the times of this ignorance God winked at, but now," he says, he's let you get away with this, "but now he commandeth all men everywhere to repent, because he hath appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man," speaking of Jesus Christ, although he didn't mention him, "by whom he ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men that he hath raised him from the dead. And when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, and others said, 'We will hear thee again in this matter.' So Paul departed from among them," and certain ones did come to Christ. All right, here is Paul's presentation to a Gentile audience. No mention of Jehovah, no mention of Abraham, or the covenant God, or the covenants, or the deliverance from Egypt, or the plagues, or anything like that. Why? Because he's speaking to a Gentile group. That's why this is. Those elements are not found in the book of Ecclesiastes. Jerusalem was a place teeming with Gentiles. And this is his audience, a philosopher, perhaps a particular philosopher, a wider group of wise people, but also perhaps instruction to many, many Gentiles. Remember, Solomon married, he had these political marriages with many, many princesses of foreign countries. Now, when the princess of Egypt comes and marries him, she doesn't just pack an overnight suitcase hop on the next camel and come down. She brings her whole retinue of servants and hairdressers and dietitians and garment makers and bakers and candlestick makers and, you know, everything else there is to do, and brings the whole staff with her. That's why Solomon has to build her a separate palace, because she has her own staff that she brings her. So when he has these multiple marriages to these many heathen, pagan, foreign queens or princesses, and makes them his queen, they bring with them a phenomenal amount of Gentiles. And that's why we read last night about how many oxen and fat oxen and deer and fowl and all that they ate. He's feeding a lot of people. When you have 700 wives and 300 concubines, that's a lot of folks, especially if they have a staff of their own. And so there are a lot of Gentiles. Plus, Solomon had made Jerusalem into a trade center of the world. So there are a lot of merchants in Jerusalem at this time. And we read last night of all of the ships that came in. All of that stuff had to be transported into Jerusalem, and there was a lot of trading and marketing going on. And so Jerusalem, in probably in no other time of its history, is just teeming with Gentiles. And this is a book that is written for Gentiles, primarily. So that's his audience, a Gentile audience. That's why, and that I think explains a lot of the absence of these Jewish elements, these Hebrew elements. Now, what is his agenda? And this gets down to the message of the book. I believe that Ecclesiastes is a cultural apologetic, but I believe that it's also a personal apology. It is, and I'm just kind of making a word play there, it is a testimony of his repentance at the end of his life. Solomon had it all, tried it all, and lost it all. And in the end, repented of it all. And as I mentioned in your notes, 12:1-7 is probably a statement of personal testimony about how he had wasted his youth trying to make life work his own way, and now looking back and as an old man, he regrets it. And we will take a look at that very powerful passage. We'll be looking at that on Saturday morning. His agenda is found in this element. This, I think this is the key to understanding the book. Ecclesiastes is a collection of goads and nails. I like the way old Bible teachers used to say, there's a key to every book of the Bible, and you'll find it under the front door mat or the back door mat, but there's a key to understanding every book. Well, Solomon put the key under the back door mat, because it's in chapter 12 and verse 11, and you have it here in Dahan's translation in his commentary, the words of the wise, or the conclusions of the thinking man. He's not talking about the godly wisdom, just the conclusions of the man who thinks. The words of the wise are like goads, and the collected sayings are like fastened nails. They come from one shepherd. Well, the question before us then is, what is a goad? A goad is a sharp... You see a picture here of a Palestinian farmer behind two oxen, and he has in his hand a goad. A goad is a sharp-pointed stick, sometimes with a piece of metal wrapped around it at the end to kind of make it a little more... pointed, and he would use this goad, and he would shove it into the flank of a slow-moving ox, and the ox would get the point, and he would move. And Solomon is saying, what I'm going to be doing in this book, or what I have done in this book, is that I have given you a lot of conclusions that if you'll think them through, you will get the point, and the point is, life doesn't work without the God Creator in your life. And so he's going to come along and ask these questions of these philosophers. I'll give you some examples here, like, okay, so you die and your dog dies, and you both lie dead on the ground. What's the difference between you and your dog? What's the point? And the point is, there isn't any point unless God is in this picture. And he says, okay, so you're wealthy, so you collect all of your wealth and you leave it to the next generation, and that guy's a fool and he spends it all and wastes it. What's the point? And the point is, there isn't any point unless God's in this picture. So Solomon is going to be goading his philosophical counterparts with all kinds of situations and saying, see, without God in the picture, all of this is empty. And he's saying, will you face that? Will you? And think, folks, he's saying, think. And if you're really honest with yourself, you get goaded a lot. And that's the point of this whole book, is to goad us into thinking. An example of this, Ted Harris, some years ago, got me playing racquetball. I played racquetball a couple of years and felt really good about that. And then one day I was thinking. One day I actually was thinking. And I thought, okay, so I get my body in shape. And so it extends my life 5 more years. And I spend those 5 years in a nursing home. What's the point? Why do I need to work so hard to extend my life? I just didn't go to heaven sooner. Well, there have been a whole lot of other benefits from it. Now I'm finding out that extended playing has greatly helped me to be healthy and help me when I had heart surgery, because I had a healthy heart and a healthy lungs. I just had really small plumbing, and they had to fix the plumbing, and so my heart is fine. But so the racquetball has helped out a lot. But what I'm saying is that kind of conclusion. I'm doing this and this and this, and it's going to end up like that. What's the point? That's a goad. And Solomon says, I want to fill your thinking with goads. And folks, you and I need to think through these things too, because some of us don't like to think real well about some of these painful things of life. And we need to think, and I'll show you, and we'll show you why. Now, look at the quote. These three paragraphs here from Dehan are really, really crucial. Just kind of put a big bracket or a box around them or whatever and come back to them often. The fool lives only for the moment. He refuses to think. It's one of his signs of a fool. He refuses to think about the solemn truths which come to everybody's mind from time to time. And secondly, he makes short-term pleasure his single reason for living. The wise man, however, observes life carefully. He thinks about what he sees and experiences. He asks questions and he tries to come to logical conclusions. He seeks long-range satisfaction and wants his life to count for something. Now, this is an important statement here. This serious-minded person is a better citizen than the man who lives only for the momentary thrills, but in some ways, he also suffers more. For he squarely faces painful truths about life and reflects upon the meaning of pain, death, and eternity. These serious thoughts serve as goads in his life. The goads Solomon includes in Ecclesiastes are the recollections, the concerns, the serious thoughts, and the guilt feelings which arise in the consciousness of one who is willing to face things as they are. Their stings are painful and do not in themselves provide the answer to man's need, but they bring to light a person's sinfulness and helpfulness, and thereby may get him started in the right direction. Now, all of us, if we spend some time thinking, and that's why it's important, I think, for us to go through the whole 13 hours of this so we can think together, because we're going to think about a lot of goading things in life that perhaps we haven't even been wanting to think about, but we need to think about, so that we are properly goaded to God. Otherwise, we can fly along in our Christian life kind of fat, dumb, and happy and not have any serious reflection and not any serious answers from God either. So, goads are the disturbing reflections of men. The disturbing reflections of men. I described this in Chapter 1 of Created for His Glory. I won't spend a lot of time on that here, but midlife crisis, supposedly midlife crisis. I'm not trying to validate that as any kind of a valid thing. But here's a man in his 40s who life hasn't turned out the way he thought it ought to turn out by this time. He hasn't left his footprints on the sands of time. And he hasn't made the impact he wants. And things haven't turned out in his family and his marriage and all this kind of thing. And he starts thinking. And he starts thinking, I've done all of this. I served God this way. And I've done this. And this hasn't turned out. What's the point? And any time you ask yourself, what's the point? You have just been goaded by that thought. And that thought is intended by God to move you a different direction than you have been going up to that point. And we'll follow that through. I mentioned in Created for His Glory, too, that I think this is what happened a lot of times in the 60s. these hippies started thinking. And they thought, here Dad has worked 40 years to retire from his company and climb this ladder to success, and he works 40 years, his fingers to the bone, only to retire and do nothing. What's the point of that? I can do nothing now. Education hasn't provided any answers to life's problems out there and society's problems. What's the point of higher education? And the point is, there isn't any point without God in it. What's the point of all of that labor for 40 years to retire and do nothing and get fat on the couch watching television? You know what? There isn't any point. And you know what? Their conclusions were right. Their solutions were wrong. But their conclusions were, this stuff isn't worth it. And you know what? It's not. And that's the whole point of Ecclesiastes. About that time, Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. And he looked this whole thing over and said, we're all going to hell in a handbasket. Enjoying the ride on the way with what little high he could have with his drugs. I want to take one song out of that time, and some of you from my era will recognize that, but I want you to see the despair of this. And I'm not promoting the song or anything like that, but when I was in high school and away from God and playing in a folk rock group in high school, my heroes at that time were Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Simon and Garfunkel, and Bob Dylan and that group. Well, Simon and Garfunkel had a song called The Sounds of Silence, probably became their most notable song. It was written shortly after John Kennedy's assassination. Stuff started to unwind here in society. And there's a lot of imagery in this song about light and darkness and the futile neon gods that people live for. And Paul Simon is frustrated that people won't listen to him, and there's so much violence and there's so much misery and so much darkness out there. And in fact, some folks looking back at this have called it a classic hymn of alienation. And I want us to see the despair in it. He poses himself as a very frustrated poet and prophet, and no one wants to hear him. Basically, he's saying, what's the point? Here are some of the words. Hello, darkness, my old friend. You see the despair in that opening statement. Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sounds of silence. Even the title, Sounds of Silence, the emptiness, the futility of that comes out. He says, in restless dreams I walked alone. And all the way through this, you see the despair. Down the streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. All of this around me that is so unpleasant. When my eyes were stabbed with the flash of a neon light, split the night and touched the sounds of silence. Fools, I said, you cannot know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my words like silent raindrops fell and echoed in the wells of silence. And the people bowed and prayed to the neon gods they made. And the sign flashed out its warning to the words that it was forming. And the sign said, the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls. Now think about how erudite those words had to be. You know, the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls. Hear them all. Tell them all. Listen to the sounds of silence. Listen to what folks are saying. This war stinks, and all of this kind of thing that they were saying at that time. And you understand that. And this became a flagship song of those days because it touched on what was going on. People were thinking and said, this doesn't stand for anything. This makes no sense to be over there in that war. It makes no sense to have a higher education. It makes no sense to climb your ladder to success. Nobody's happy anyway. And you know what? They were right. The conclusion was right. The solution was wrong. And Solomon is going to tell us, if you will take the time to look around, look at your own life, and consider what is going on in the world around you, if you really, really think about it, you're going to be goaded. And if God is not in the center of your thinking, it's going to drive you to despair. And I believe that this reflection-based despair has fueled many, many movements through history, art history, music history, philosophical history, because when God is left out of man, God made man to have a desire for transcendence. By transcendence, I mean an understanding that there's something beyond what's happening here that makes meaning to all of this. Transcendence, something that transcends or is above what's going on down here. And I want to trace that for just a few minutes through art history. And you may not be interested in art at all. It's kind of a growing interest in mine because I have a daughter who's an art major. And on our vacation, we spend a lot of time in art galleries. And so I'm learning. And I put together some things here for another presentation a while back, but I want just to read through this, and I want to show you some things here where this despair is driving many, many things. And if you will understand the components of despair, you will understand a lot about our culture and a lot of what has gone on in past history. Despair, I mentioned here, is the hopelessness of life without light. And it is what Ruckmacher calls in modern art, in The Death of Culture, man in a box. Here is man without God. All he can do is look around at him. This isn't anywhere in your notes. But here is man. He feels trapped in this box. He looks around, and we're going to see this with Solomon. He tries everything in the box. And he says, this just doesn't work. And Ruckmacher calls that man in the box. He's man tortured by his own limitations, harassed by a cursed world that further limits him, and he's sentenced to find meaning in what he can experience and know on the physical plane only. He finds himself restless and trapped and empty and despairing. Now, folks, there's an important thing for us that's going to come up with. If you have any of those same thoughts and you feel, you are thinking like you are restless and trapped and empty and despairing, you are also trapped in the box. Man in the box. The existentialist says, and this is several movements throughout history, has said, you have to leap out of the box. Meaning is found outside of the box. Now, there's a sense of that that's true. But when God wasn't in their picture, all they could do is find meaning in some kind of existential experience. And it is an irrational leap, which is reflected in certain artistic movements, particularly Dada, surrealism, abstract expressionism, and much modern art. It's an attempt to say the real meaning in life is found in something outside of this box. And by the way, that's where we started to get to thinking, we got to think outside the box. Now, we use that in a little different worldview here and say, we got to think about some things we haven't thought about before. The existentialist says the whole meaning of life. Remember, he says, down here in this box, there's nothing down here that has any taste in it. But there's taste somewhere, and it's probably outside that box. And they're true, and they're right, it is. But without God in that picture, all they can come up with is some fantasy of what's outside the box. The Bible answer is not leap outside of the box, but look outside the box. The message is listen to the transcendent Creator in His written word to you. Look closely at what He reveals about His nature in the creation around you. Don't ignore the moral standards He's placed in your conscience that remind you that something exists above your own personal desires. Folks, our hope doesn't come from anything in the box. Everything in the box is transient and is cursed. We must live in it during our earthly pilgrimage, but as you see in the notes there at the top, the meaning of life is found outside the box in a transcendent God. Dr. Bob Third captured that in the theme for the 1999-2000 school year at BJU, learning from above how to live here below. You have to look outside the box to make any sense of what's going on down here. Today, people are saying man is dehumanized, and he's treated as a cog in the machinery and all this kind of thing. And the reason he is despairing is because he's mistreated. He's mistreated by this group that's in power and by that group that's in power and by this thing, and he's been mistreated by that thing, and the environmentalists. The environment is messing up life for him, and he's reduced to just another one of the creatures out there, and all of these are the problem. No, the problem is nothing down here is supposed to give meaning to life. let's trace that very quickly through some art history. For example, the ancient civilizations of Greece and Rome sought artistic excellence. And they said the meaning of life, there is a transcendence in life, and it's in the beauty of this human form. Their objective was to achieve the purest and the highest standards of beauty. Now, I want you to understand something here. They believed, at least artistically, in a large sense, they believed in high standards. But I want to tell you something, folks. High standards of any sort don't satisfy the soul without God. They acknowledged transcendent virtues of beauty and courage and harmony and order and so forth. Their understanding of these virtues, however, was corrupted by their paganism. While they produced many beautiful works of art, their religion allowed and fostered vices which destroyed their civilization. The point I'm trying to make here is that even an appreciation of transcendent virtues, like beauty and morality and all of this, you can have an appreciation for that and still lead to darkness and despair if there's no personal relationship with the Creator God. The Dark Ages, which followed that, brought a synthesis of Judeo-Christian and Greco-Roman and Germanic influences. And individuals, this is back in the Dark Ages, in the feudal days, individuals sought salvation through a religious system, this was the Roman Church, that promoted pilgrimages to cathedrals, supposedly housing relics of saints. At the same time, monasticism grew because of its promise of spiritual satisfaction. So here we have some phenomenal architecture that is coming out in this day, in what we call the Dark Ages. And Dr. Salter said, these are not the Dark Ages. These are some phenomenal ages of what was produced during that time. But they were dark and that God was not in this picture. Can you imagine what it was like for a slave in one of these days to come? I mean, he lives out in the fields and in a hovel somewhere, working for his master, the king. And he gets to come in one day a week into this kind of a cathedral. Can you imagine the sensations that fellow experiences coming into this kind of thing? And in fact, the sense of transcendence. Why all these cathedrals? Why all this stained glass? 7.5 acres of stained glass in the Cathedral of Chartres. 7.5 acres. Why all of this? Because man was seeking for some sense of transcendence. Something that was ethereal, that was above everything else. Soaring stonework, shimmering stained glass, vast open spaces and dazzling heights gave a breathtaking experience of transcendence or otherworldliness to the poor peasant whose life otherwise was harsh and meaningless. In fact, the designer of the Cathedral of Chartres said that he believed that the light coming through these stained glass pieces, he put, became divine light, a direct manifestation of the Spirit of God. Architects sought to create in the cathedrals a special part of the universe suspended between heaven and earth. The implied promise to the worshiper, surrounded as he was by the best high culture could ever offer, was that he could experience something divine amidst the saints and sights and smells and sounds of the cathedral. Now, do you understand the thirst for the transcendence and the apparent experience of some transcendence of a person coming in here? Like, God is here. God has to be here. See what I'm saying? But when God isn't here, you walk away from that with a pit in your stomach and saying, what's the point of all of this? And this is exactly how movement after movement came. They would try one thing, and the next generation would come back and try that and say, that's pointless. And they would try something else. And then the next generation would come back and say, that doesn't work. Why did they do that? And it went on and on and on like that. Every generation, every history, every turn, every cycle is happening this way. And by the way, there's a lesson for us in the modern church here. We reject that the experience of transcendence comes from stained glass and incense and robes and Latin mantras that are repeated over and over again as a way to create an atmosphere of transcendence. Do we not? They say, this doesn't make... I mean, you can experience... I mean, you walk in one of these cathedrals and, folks, you are wowed. Even today, we're wowed. But don't we reject that and say, this is not an experience that is a valid experience? These are people trying to find some experience in all of the sights and the sounds and the smells of the cathedral. But then we in our pop culture try to generate an experience of transcendence with a driving rock in CCM or an ethereal mantra-like chanting over and over again in our praise and worship of Thou art worthy, Thou art worthy, Thou art worthy, Thou, and our hands raised up, and we can create an experience of transcendence and God not be in it at all. I'm not saying that for every believer who's in that, that's the case. I think there's some in there who are genuinely seeking God and finding Him, because when you seek after God, you will be found of Him. I think they're wrong in many, many areas, but there are a whole lot of people being duped into the same thing these peasants were, that if you come here, you can experience a transcendent thing. And a lot of people do experience transcendence in that, and God's not in it. And they think He is, and they're going to be despairing at the end and saying, what's the point of all that? And there isn't any point, because God's not in that either. So, you know, we just come to these services and we sing the same old hymns. And you know what? That's not bad. Because those are filled with doctrine. And if your soul isn't thrilled with doctrine, there's a problem with your soul. And it's like somebody said, the fact that you don't like Beethoven is a greater reflection on you than Beethoven. The fact that your heart doesn't resound to these hymns is a greater reflection on you than it is on those artists. On those hymn writers and those and the folks who wrote the hymns and the music, the words and the music. You can come to hear, and the hymns don't get you all riled up like that. And if you walk away empty, it shows your own heart. It's kind of like having Christianity without the drug. You have to deal with life as you are. If you don't have the drug of all of this experience around you, kind of artificially pumping you up. The sad reality going on here, the sad reality is that transcendence of atmosphere, as in the cathedrals, and transcendence of architecture cannot quench the thirst of a soul for a relationship with a living God. The result then was darkness, despair. And that same, and then one of the reactions that came a little bit later on was the Renaissance. Here's where people came along and said, you know what? The answer was back in that beauty in the classical times. We should have statuary like we had back there. We ought to be doing paintings like we did back there. The answer really was back there. Let's do it again. And so in a humanistic attempt to bring some meaning back into life, there was a renaissance of the classical approaches to things. And the rich warmth of Baroque art, which is most of what we have over in the art gallery at Bob Jones, followed immediately after that, or came out of that period. Following it, that was taken to an extreme, with ornate extravagance of Rococo, this gaudy, lush kind of stuff, which was the stuffiness and the pride of the aristocracy behind driving that. And that promoted an art form without substance and beauty without character. Again, the absence of a transcendent God in it left just an elegant emptiness in all of that fine arts. The reign of terror protested that reign of reason, and the pendulum swung once again in search of transcendence and gave birth to Romanticism. Romanticism brought about a return to transcendent themes of beauty and order and nobility. But with God, without God to inject humility into the worldview, it produced snobbishness in some and degenerated into primitivism in others, both unattractive options. The stream continued in art with the Impressionists and Post-Impressionists. Each artist sought some way to depict life and emotions that expressed the more mystical dimensions of life. They were looking for transcendence. Again, the search for transcendence. Though Impressionists protested against the shallowness of the Salon paintings, they themselves degenerated to the vulgar, since their worldview was not rooted in a transcendent God. Monet himself said, quote, there is no reality. Only the sensations are real, end of quote. Pablo Picasso broke all the rules, and his cubism became the final declaration of independence from the Renaissance. But Picasso's own friend observed, quote, the monsters of his mind drive us to despair, end of quote. Pessimism about that human condition fueled expressionism, which often portrayed troubled figures tormented with spiritual despair. Dada, anti-everything, followed. It was further refined in surrealism. Based upon dreams and dream worlds, surrealism attempted to evade all control of reason and promoted complete irrationality. You saw a picture of that a little bit earlier when we said leap outside the box. The viewer can feel the despair, the agony, the absurdity in surreal works. For to the artist, these were the only realities, and they were right. Without God, this is all that is left to the honest, thinking man. Now, all I want you to see from this, and you don't have to like art history, and you don't have to like the 60s music, and you shouldn't like the 60s music, all right? All I'm saying is, if you follow movement after movement after movement, it was a reaction to the despair of the previous one that didn't deliver the goods. And these people were all heady about, and the current generation was all heady about what they were discovering, and then they pass it on to the next generation, and they look back at that and said, that stinks. We got to try something else. And so we have all of these pendulum swings. It's driven by the goads of life. People thinking about life. And this is why I say that history is merely the chronicle of the goads men have felt as they tried to make life work without God at the center. History is merely the chronicle of the goads men have tried, they have felt as they tried to make life work without God at the center. And folks, if you and I don't learn the lesson Solomon is going to teach us this week, we're going to be part of the also-rans too. And the next generation of Christians that are produced out of our families are going to look at mom and dad and say, you know what? They were miserable. And they were always fighting and bickering about this, and they had all these problems, and they were trying out materialism, and they were trying out sensuality. You know what? Christianity doesn't work. Their brand doesn't work. That's right. Because God's not at the center of what they're doing. That's why we lose the next generation. Because there's no sense of transcendence in the present Christians they're dealing with. So these are the goads, the disturbing reflections of men. What are the nails? The nails are the revelations of God. Solomon said, the conclusions of the thinking man are like goads and nails. These nails were the tent stakes. We wouldn't use the word nail today. We wouldn't say, son, we've got to put this tent stake in. We've got to fasten this tent wire or rope down here. Bring me a nail. We would say, bring me a stake. And that's what this nail was the large stake that a Bedouin shepherd would use to tie down the ends of the ropes that would hold up his tent in the storms out there on the desert. And Solomon is saying there are some things in this book that you're going to find that are nails. They are stabilizing truths about the nature of God and His Word that will stabilize your life. Now, Ecclesiastes has proportionately fewer nails than goads. It's got a whole bushel of goads and just a few nails, but there are some nails here. Now, this is Solomon's agenda. Goad his audience into abandoning their worldview. Get them moving. And his approach to this is through four discourses. The secret of what I'm calling the secret of pleasure, the secret of providence in life, the secret of prosperity, and the secret of perseverance in life. And I'm calling all of those together the secrets of the good life. Now, again, scholars have divided this book into several different ways. In fact, I sometimes think as a preacher, I wonder when I get to heaven and talk to the Apostle Paul if he will even recognize any of the stuff I have preached from his books. You know, say, no, Paul was saying this and this and this. I really hope he was. You know, but we have so. Sometimes you can divide it all different kinds of ways. And it's like someone said, there are two different kinds of people in the world. Those who divide the world into two kinds of people and those who don't. And there are two kinds of people who study Ecclesiastes. Those who divide it into four discourses and those who don't. Some divided into three and five and so forth. But I really think there are four here because they all have the same conclusion. It's kind of like the same invitation at the end. And we'll take a look at that as we come to each one of these discourses. So the conclusion here is, are you getting the point or the goad? This is the question for us. I tell you, sometimes when I have given this material, some folks, as the time went on, were quite disturbed and quite angry. I hope not at me, but at life, because life hadn't given them what they thought it ought to give. And the ones who were most disturbed were the ones in the 40s and the 50s age group. Because when they really started thinking, they realized, you know what, I've missed the point on a lot of stuff. Well, that's not hopeless for us. God is an amazing God. He can make up for a lot of time. He says in Joel 2 that He knows how to restore the years the locusts have eaten. Amazing God. But we have to be willing to be goaded by God. Are we really willing to seriously think about our life this week and about the way we think about life? How stable are we? How reflective are we? Do we ever stop and think? And if not, why not? If all we're thinking about is, what is my next grocery list? What is the next thing I got to do in the car? What is the next thing I got to do here? And what is the next thing I got to do in my job? And we don't spend any time thinking about how our life is working and how it's turning out. We're never going to be goaded enough to propel us to God. And Solomon is saying through this book, think, folks, think, think, think. You have to reflect. And that's why I say in conclusion here, reflection minus revelation equals despair. If you do like the hippies did and just reflect without any revelation from God, it will always end up in despair, just like in these art movements. You reflect on the meaning of life without God at the center of this, and it has to end in despair. It's intended. That's a promise from God that it will be, that it will end that way. Now, here's what happens to most of us. We have a lot of revelation, but no reflection, and that ends up in self-deception. We think we're all right, and we have no clue how far off we are. We have a lot of input, but very little reflection. And we're self-deceived. And our lives are joyless and pointless a lot of times. And we wonder why the next generation doesn't want what we have. Who would want it? It's not attractive at all. And we've got to be willing to be goaded. But reflection with revelation ends up in dependency. If you will take the time to hear from God and will think about your life and what His Word has to say about it, it will drive you to God, and that's the point. You have to be aware of both the goads in your life and the nails from your God to be stable and useful. Lord Jesus, I pray that You would help us during these sessions to be willing to look at our lives and hear the message from You of how desperately we need You, and we often don't even realize that. And I pray that You would teach us through this week and give us understanding, I pray in Your name. Amen.